do a Sahana Baba too, and then we'll see if we get to the Gita. Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Upanantu Sahaviryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavatitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Let's do it again. Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Upanantu Saha Viryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavatitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Let me talk for a little bit about this whole process of meditation and some of the things that are very helpful, because some of you don't know it, and I know everyone wants to hear it again, so I'll do it. It'd be nice to go through these steps. It makes a big difference, I think, in your meditative practice. So I usually talk about it in terms of steps, even how to start and with what attitude to begin meditating. So I'm going to just take it step by step by step and kind of explain the rationale, certain things to understand about it, because it'll help you have a more fruitful meditation, a more deeper, relaxing meditation, really. So, first thing, when you sit for meditation, it's very nice for the psyche if you don't decide the amount of time you're going to be sitting for. In other words, if you decide that, okay, every day for the next week I'm going to meditate for 1 hour a day in the morning, and then you might have to and an hour in the afternoon. And then that next day comes and you think, well, I'm not going to start that today because I don't really have an hour. I'm too busy today, and I don't know, I'm going to be tired at night, I don't want to start this. And say, well, I'm only going to do it 1 hour every morning. But then that comes, well, I'm really busy this morning. I don't have an hour, so I'm not going to start. I'm not going to do it. The whole problem is that you've set up this amount of time as a rule. So I would say don't have that rule. And just every day you sit for meditation, whether it's for 1 minute, or it's just not about time. It's just that you take that moment to be with yourself, and that moment will last for however long you're available for that. Whether it's 10 seconds or 3 hours, it doesn't make any difference at all. It's whatever the day brings and how much time you have during that day and the attitude of your own psyche and body and so many things. So that's the first thing. Next thing is that when you sit for meditation, you should be able to find a posture that is comfortable, where you can actually let the whole body relax for a good length of time. It's not about time, but you don't want in 5 minutes your knees to start hurting, for instance. You want to be in a position where your body is supported, either because you have a good asana, say you have done yoga for a while and you have a good asana and your back is strong and you can sit, or maybe you need a back rest or a back jack or something, you know, or maybe your legs need to be down instead of cross-legged, you know, because if for a lot of especially Westerners who aren't sitting with cross-legged from childhood, they can get, you know, knee trouble, etc. And that is not conducive to meditation. In meditation, you want to be able to totally relax your body to the point of not being aware of it. And so now is not the time to be testing it, you know, and pushing it. Like say if we're working on a given asana, you can kind of push the envelope a little bit, you know, until you have a little stretching as far as you can stretch without hurting yourself, you know, and then you have to let go of that and relax. That's when you're working on your asana, working on yoga. But when you're going to meditate at that time, you want a body in a position that can completely relax, where you feel comfortable, not your Otherwise, also the problem is I don't want to sit because my knees are going to start hurting. It's just, it's just definitely not a situation where I'm not going into something that is shanti. You know, I have to fight the pain. Okay, so it sounds obvious, right? But honestly, people do set up these situations so much time every day, you know, like a rule. And, you know, you're supposed to be sitting in lotus position, so I am going to sit in lotus position for half an hour, even though it's in excruciating pain and my legs start going to sleep after, 5 minutes. You're just defeating the purpose, is what I'm saying. And so it's just these simple things, they're notions that we need to get rid of right away. That's what I'm saying. Okay. Next thing is... these are statements of the obvious that are not realized. This statement of the obvious is that the world, all living beings, you know, respond to love in a positive way. And they respond to hate or criticism in a very negative way. You know, it's just, we all know it. You know, we experience it all of the time. Like if you're in a group of people and everybody's positive toward you, you can relax so deeply, you know. You feel a sense of well-being just by the love and respect of the people around you that feeds you. In fact, Kohut, a great psychologist, says that positive mirroring, so what he says, is oxygen for the soul. Mm-hmm. You know, positive mirroring is oxygen for the soul. In other words, if you remove oxygen from the body suffers and dies. If you remove that positive mirroring from the soul, you know, it suffers and dies and withers away.
What is this other word? Positive mirroring?
Mirroring. Mirroring.
Ah, mirroring. Okay.
Mirroring, yeah. Do you know what I mean by it?
Hey.
Yeah. Okay. So, they've even done, you know, studies where they put electrodes on, you know, on plants, and they measure the anxiety and relaxation of a plant around positive and negative feedback, and the plant definitely mm-hmm. reacts, you know, with anxiousness and with fear if there's a negative stimulus. They've done it with water crystals, you know, with water. Water in a negative environment, if you freeze the water, it'll form deformed ice crystals. In a positive environment, beautiful ice crystals. Sounds very, very simple. So now we notice this in our environment. So we have, say, we have people who are positive toward us in our environment, a nice circle, and then one person comes in who is really doesn't like us, has no respect for us, and is negative. Now all of a sudden, the positive environment is definitely affected by this negative personal presence. It's not a joke, it's visceral. Right? And the whole body, not the mind reacts to it, the body reacts to it. You know? And so immediately the environment, that type of environment, can affect our shanti. So that's why they even say, like in chapter 13 of the Gita, when they're going through all of these qualities of mani, tuam, adambi, tuam, ahimsa, shanti, adarjavana, it just goes through all of the values. And it also talks about, you know, sitting in a quiet, simple place, a peaceful place, so that you don't have to worry about that type of thing. Now, that's all obvious, well known in terms of our external environment. But what we often don't realize is that our internal environment we have to live with day in and day out is that internal environment positive toward us or negative. In other words, like for instance, how do I feel about my body? How do I address my body? Like say I'm sitting and I'm trying to relax, you know? I mean this is ridiculous, but I'm just gonna do it. Mm-hmm. Or sitting, I'm trying to relax. Relax! Will you please relax? Just relax. It's ridiculous, right? It's ridiculous. You know? That's a dinner, but we... Nothing. I mean, it's... Go ahead. I'm
waiting.
No, I'm waiting.
See what you did?
Just relax, will you?
I made him do it.
Okay, relax.
No, but I mean, this is so obvious, but I'm telling you, it's a major thing, you know, that if you, like, say if you even hold with gentleness, you run your hand over your arm, you can feel that, you know, you feel it, you know, and if you even become with a positive attitude, if you become conscious of your hand, the hand feels it, the body feels it. If you say to your body, if you spend a moment to appreciate your body and you thank it, and with sincerity, say, thank you for all that you do for me. You know, like if I were to say to you, thank you, you know, for everything that you've been doing for me, I really appreciate it. And you mean it. I mean, you're not playing, you really mean it. How does the other person feel? I know how I feel. Sometimes it's embarrassing that it makes you so happy. You try to kind of hide your happiness. You know? But this is all real stuff, you know? You know? And so your body and your mind and the whole upadi, the whole body, mind, sense organs, it responds, you know, to respect and to love and to care and to appreciation, all of these things, it has a very visceral reaction to it. And it has a hurtful, it has a hurt and a tightening and kind of a painful, unhealthy, unwholesome reaction to a critical voice. But the thing is, we don't always recognize what the way that we're talking, the kind of inner voices we have, if it's positive or negative. Because from childhood, this positive and negative, we start it this internal voice from such a young age that you don't necessarily even know that you're talking negatively to yourself because you're not really listening. But once you start listening, you can see, you know, what type of what I call introjects, you know, what type of internalized little people. Like the internalized father, the internalized mother, the internalized siblings that talked to you when you were growing up in a particular way, your psyche, you know, mimics those type of voices and feelings internally. And so you can naturally have an internal self-talk that is hurtful to you and keeps you very constricted, you know. And your mind keeps the other part of the mind that's kind of the victim of this negative self-talk keeps resisting, reacting, fighting back, feeling dejected, feeling hurt. It can go through a whole myriad of emotions just in response to this negative or critical self-talk. And so when we're going to contemplate, before contemplation is even meaningful, this has to be addressed. So this is part of the contemplative process, you know, where when I'm trying to relax my body, the first thing I have to do there's an attitude. I have to approach my body with an attitude of love and respect and gratitude, and I just spend some time with it, you know. Giving it that type of thanks, you know, and then you can feel, actually as you do that, you can feel its response. And so in that attitude of thanks and appreciation and respect, then you do your relaxation exercises, you know, but you have nothing working against you. Right, so whatever exercises you do to just, you know, relax the body, run your mind through the body, objectify your body, all the things that we do, those exercises are being done with this attitude backing it, right? Mm-hmm. And then you find that the body relaxes in a deeper way, in a different way, in a meaningful way, you know. Now, the same is going to be true of your mind. The mind can't relax in the presence of someone who doesn't like it. Right? Just like we can't relax in the presence of someone who doesn't like us. It's very difficult. You know, we just endure, basically. Right? Say somebody doesn't like you, is critical of you, or, you know, feels superior to you, or you're not valued by them, or whatever, all the negative things that can be taking place there. You're in the presence of such a person, you know, you just have to handle it. And you can, you know, learn, we have different ways of handling that, but it is handling it, right? You know, we can learn different ways to handle it. But if the person that's sitting before us, you know, is positive, we don't have to handle anything. There's no handling, right? There's just, the mind is relaxed. And so now, that's fine. We have to handle the world all the time. But it's a shame. I won't even say it like that. We can, just by becoming conscious of all of these processes, we can have an inner environment that doesn't require handling. We don't have to handle it. Because there's not a critical, instead of a critical voice, there's an inner, what I call the inner friend. And inner friend, so if you have a friend, let me just give you some what I think are key words. A friend is somebody who likes you, you know, and respects you. It's two things. They like you and they respect you. And if you think of those two, you can say they love you, but besides the love, there should be like and respect, you know. And then if that like and respect is there, then whatever problems you happen to be going through, or whatever mistakes you've made, or whatever it is, that person gives you the benefit of the doubt, you know, because they like you, they respect you. Respect means they think you're a good person, you know, and you're dealing with this problem right now. You're a good person, you know, a likable person, a person that they care about, who's dealing with this problem. So, you know, that's how what we want. We want that internally. I'm dealing with this problem, or I behaved in a way that I wish I hadn't behaved. Now, how is that inner voice reacting to that? Is it reacting as somebody who loves me, likes me, respects me, and knows I'm doing the best I can, and it wants to help? Is that the inner environment? You know, or is it one that says, look at what a screw-up you are. Whatever form that critic takes, what a screw-up you are. If that's so, then there's just a continual beating down. That's what I say, you're continually being beaten down. And so if we don't, let me put it positively, in the meditative process, if we go step by step by step, practicing each one of these things, you know, step by step by step, what happens is, first of all, we learn how to be that way. Right? Because the rewards are so great. The rewards are great, and your mind really appreciates it. But then it becomes something that is not just about meditating. It's just a natural way of being. And so it's just a way to kind of correct whatever type of negative voices are there. Okay? This is toward the mind now. Now, those negative voices, inner self-talk, are there toward your conscious mind. Look what we just did, how stupid, you know. They can also be, and so we want to correct that, but we also need to go in and repair what is in the unconscious. Now, what I mean by that is that in the unconscious, you say for the first 6 years, and longer also, but particularly before the age of reason, you are bringing into your unconscious all of the traumas that as a little child you weren't able to handle. And, you know, those those traumas and hurts can be much bigger than they were in real life, because you're a little child and you're like 3 feet tall or 2.5 feet tall, and your parents are, you know, 6 feet tall. You know, and so their behavior and what they do is going to be, you're going to respond to differently than if you too, you were also 6 feet tall. See what I mean? So even if the thing from the standpoint of the parent may not be traumatic from the standpoint of the little child, it can be very, very traumatic, very hurtful, you know? And then if the parent is violent, I mean, there are violent parents, there's abusive parents, all these kind of things, or parents that lose their temper, all kinds of things that are very hard on a child. And so a lot of things get internalized and put into the unconscious, and they stay there. That's the problem. The unconscious and our defense system does a really great job of, when you're a little child, of swallowing all the stuff in order to protect the child so the child can go on and function. Just swallow. And so now you're carrying in the body and in the unconscious a lot of hurts. And some, depending upon your background, when you were little, it can be much more for some than for others. You know, much more devastating for some than for others. But nobody's off scot-free. And the reason is that we're little and they're big, you know? Very little and they're very big. And so what might be just normal for a parent, just normal behavior, can really be shocking for a little child. So that type of thing. Yeah. So that means that we need to, and once in the unconscious, the defense system is in place. The defense system is in place to keep it in the unconscious. Now, 50 years later, that defense system is still doing its job. You know. And I'm not 3 years old anymore, you know. I'm 50 years old, 60 years old, but still doing its job. And so that means that those hurts and pains are going to be triggered, you know, in a lot of different ways by the environment, those things that are held underneath. And so what we need to do is go in. You have to learn how to go into the unconscious and go into some dialogue with those parts that are really what we'd call, what Jung will call, split off parts of ourself. Once split off. Split off. So once you learn how to do that, you know, then that also, it's a huge relief to the unconscious. And that also becomes a way of life, because you create a porous relationship between you and your unconscious, where there's a dialogue going on and you're very sensitive to feelings and hurts and all the emotions that take place in the psyche. You don't just automatically assume that it's something caused by out here. Something out here is a trigger, but then you go directly to the source itself to see what's really happening. So you learn how to do that, and that gives your unconscious a lot of shanti. So now it's not just the conscious mind that has some shanti, it's the unconscious mind also, because of your dialogical relationship with it. So you see how we're kind of moving here step by step by step, just to create create a mind that is taken care of in such a way that meditation is useful to sit, because now when we really start meditating, kind of resolving the mind into the self, that becomes useful. And it is also, just like these other steps, an exercise. Because, in fact, what you're realizing is what is. And so what starts out as a meditative practice actually becomes just natural. You know, because it's not like yourself isn't there. It's not as though the mind is something away from the self. That whole satya-mitya relationship is there. You know, where the self that you are, the self that is free and whole and is Brahman, that self, you know, is the self that the mind enjoys. It's just, and the unconscious enjoys, the body enjoys. But the body and mind and sense organs, first of all, they're ignorant of it. They don't know it, and so knowledge has to take place. And then they also have all of these unconscious problems, you know, or there's a level of unconscious problems and a level of conscious problems that you're unconscious of. Does that make sense? Like there are attitudes and things that you're doing and self-talk that you're doing in the conscious world that you just automatically take for granted. You haven't even noticed it. And then there's things that are really held in the unconscious where you have to dive into the unconscious and, you know, give it some time. So when that happens, there's certain shanti that takes place, and now your mind is in a position to meditate upon what you see over and over at the time of teaching, right? Now, that becomes like, in a sense, an exercise of differentiation, right? Because normally yourself is totally identified with, like, your thoughts and your feelings and your body. There hasn't been any type of real differentiation there. And so when we slow everything down, we make the body relaxed and the mind relaxed. We have an inner depth, you know. And then we let the mind recognize my own presence. And we've just created a perfect environment to do that because it's not used to doing that. But once it's done it, and again you've gotten used to yourself, then what is the difference between here with your eyes open and with your eyes closed? Yourself is still the same. Yourself is still differentiated. Your mind still has shanti, you know. But in order to really make myself aware of that, awaken myself to the truth of my own being, and to bring about an unconscious environment that allows for shanti, you know, We have to work on that. We have to do it. So you need knowledge. When we say in Advaita Vedanta that there are two sadhanas. One sadhana is called Upayanishta. Upayanishta is, what are the sadhanas for me to gain knowledge? You know, what is the means of knowledge for me to know myself? That is Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana. You know, where Shravana is where I'm exposed to a teacher who is teaching the Upanishads and or Prakarana Granthas texts that are revealing the nature of the Upanishads. So basically, they are an Upanishad in themselves. So the teaching of the Upanishads, so in such a way that I can understand clearly the vision of the Upanishads. There's a whole teaching methodology for that, Shravana. Mm. Manana is where any doubts that I might have in my mind about the nature of that teaching are addressed. What you might say, well, you say that the Upanishads are saying that I am just one. Well, why can't I just be one consciousness and you be one consciousness? Why can't there be two consciousnesses? You know what I mean? So that's not what the Upanishad says. The Upanishad says there is one consciousness. The whole teaching methodology say there's one consciousness, that I am the one consciousness, the same in all beings. But then you might say, well, yeah, but I think there's many consciousnesses, and there are many infinite consciousnesses. Why can't it be like that? You know, and so that has to be addressed in its own right. That's manana. You know, or you could say, why can't the body be consciousness? The body produces consciousness. It's just an epiphenomena of the body. That's a doubt. It's not what the Upanishads say. It's a doubt that you're attacking the Upanishads with your doubt. I don't think it's that way. I think it's this way. That's manana. Shravana is where you can say, well, are the Upanishads saying this or are they saying that? You know, in this verse, in this shloka, is this what this shloka means or does it mean this? See what I mean? So shravana has to do with clarity of vision, really seeing the vision, understanding it. Manana has to do with clarifying any doubts that one might have about the veracity of that vision. And Nididhyasana is the giving the mind the time just to contemplate, to absorb, to sit in the truth of that vision. That's Upayanishta. Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana. It's the teaching methodology for gaining self-knowledge. But that self-knowledge takes place in the mind. The mind has to be available for it. right? So we have what's called Upayanishta. Upayanishta is how to gain a mind, you know, a body mind that is capable of gaining this knowledge. And that's where, you know, all the karma yoga comes in, dharma, dharmic behavior, karma yoga, meditative exercises, you know, to bring the mind into a state of shanti. And so all of these things that I'm teaching you right now fall into Upayanishta, because even for Nididhyasana, you need a mind, you know, and body that is capable of contemplation and capable of shravana. You know, if the unconscious can sabotage you, because it's hurting and it wants some attention. You know, and you're sitting in class and the teacher is blah, blah, blah. And what your unconscious wants, you know, is somebody to pay attention to it. And that's right. If there's pain and there are unresolved things, it does want your attention, and it doesn't really want you to go running off doing other things, you know, and think you're happy. It does not want you to think that you're happy and everything's fine. When it is having hurts and problems, but those hurts and problems are in the unconscious and they need to be addressed. And so they will be, in a sense, a certain sabotage. So this type of thing, it's all precursors to Nididhyasana and to having a mind and body that truly can be available even to this teaching methodology. Because if the... There's another thing, like often when at the beginning of meditation, let our mind wander. Just let it wander. Give it some time, you know, to settle down, that type of thing. You know, that's just to give the mind the optimal situation and respect that can allow it to deeply relax and deeply be available. Mm-hmm. So these things and whatever we do here in meditation, it naturally becomes a way of being, just a way of living, you know. And the recognition of yourself that you have in meditation is a recognition, I mean, whether you're in meditation or not in meditation, yourself is still there. It's still there. It's still you. It hasn't gone anywhere at all. And it's not away from the mind. And so you don't need to be in meditation to recognize it. Right? But once you know. You know, you can know at the time of teaching. You can see it. And if you have shanti, then you don't have to go in meditation to see it again. You go in meditation to settle everything down, to make the mind quiet and relaxed, so that you can be with that and get some differentiation. But if you know yourself, you know, and your mind and body have a proper attitude to themselves and to the world, there's no reason to be in meditation, because you're not away from yourself. You would say, well, I'm already in meditation. I mean, what are you going to say? You see what I mean? So these precursors to absorbing your mind, you're just sitting with your mind, are really important, because otherwise you're working against yourself. That's the idea. Everybody see what I'm saying? Okay, so why don't we do a meditation? You want to?
Yeah, I'd love to. Okay.
Okay, so let yourself get into a comfortable position. You can really relax your body and take a few deep breaths just to settle in. I'm going to spend just a minute or so just being aware of your body and actually thanking your body for all that it does. It's amazing when you start to think about But this, what it means to have a body, is something. It's a miracle. It's something. It's very rare. Also, it's considered very rare to have a body, a physical, a human body. In terms of the transmigration of the soul, of the jiva, you're in the. In the minority to take a human birth. And your body is such a faithful servant. So actually thank it like you would thank a friend. And in that attitude of friendship and gratitude and respect, and let your body relax and just enjoy, bask in that attitude. And as your body enjoys relaxing, let your mind also relax. Sometimes Swamiji likens the relaxation of the mind as if you have a dog that you love and you take the dog to a big meadow, fenced meadow, and you just let the dog run through the meadow, jumping and barking and running back and forth and doing flips, whatever it does. How you would feel watching your dog run and be a dog. You're totally free to be a dog. Like that, you can let your mind just wander and be totally free to be a mind, to get to know the mind as a mind, what it's capable of. The associative thinking. You can just thank your mind, be grateful. And let it relax as the body also continues to relax. Now ask your mind, your conscious mind, is there anything that it needs to tell you or that it's concerned about, that it wants you to know about? Maybe there's a list of things that it's concerned that you won't remember or will forget to do, or maybe there's some people that you have to deal with. Just ask the mind if there's any concerns that it has, and just let it tell you. Whatever it is, so just spend a minute doing that. You have to actually ask using words, what are your concerns? Is there anything you want to tell me? To talk to it as though it's a person that you're addressing. you can say, is there anything else? Once the list is finished. Now I'd like you to address your unconscious, all the little ones inside, and just you can just ask, does anybody inside have anything they want to tell me? Just ask and see. And if more than one raises their hand and wants to talk, tell them that you'll talk to each one of them. That even if you're not able to talk to each one today, that you'll come back tomorrow or later on. And if there's one that's hurt inside, you can love that part, and just like you would love a little child, your child, and ask what's wrong and let that part tell you all about it and feel loved and comforted by you. Be a good listener and let those parts talk. You can practice over the week going into your unconscious, into your feelings actually, and talking to the feelings. What is it that's wrong? What are you really feeling? Tell me about that. Being there present. Learning how to spend time with yourself as somebody who truly cares, so that your mind has the pleasure of being in the presence of somebody who loves and respects it, and your body has the pleasure of being in the company of somebody who loves and respects it. Even if there's an inner critic, when you become aware of that inner critic, think of it as a young child who's interjected that. It's a 3-year-old. And you can tell that part that it's okay. It doesn't have to worry. That part's good also. Let the final say be the one who cares. I'm going to say a few more things about this, okay? So that we have it in kind of a whole piece, and I'll work on it, hopefully I'll work on it next Thursday. If we look at the inner, what I'm calling the inner friend, as really being the buddhi, you know, the buddhi is what really holds your knowledge. It's the one that is the mature one in the system. And for anybody, really, the buddhi is the one that's gaining knowledge and that can objectify the body and the mind, the manas. The manas holds the unconscious also. And there's so many moods and emotions and things that are going on in the mind and the manas. The buddhi can respond to and hold and dialogue with and talk to the manas just on a conscious level. And it can on an unconscious level too. You know, by saying what is going on, that it's going to a deeper level. It's going to the unconscious. What are you thinking about? So your buddhi is the one that gains knowledge and that is capable of being a friend and of having shanti. You know, the one that is a friend and has shanti and is holding the agitated mind or is holding the hurt body. See what I mean? Now it's so to start with, what we're doing is getting this buddhi, making it an inner friend, you're evoking the inner friend, just like you would evoke if I'm with my friend, you know, that I'm trying to help or whatever is happening, I am the friend to that person, say. So that friendship has been evoked. So that friendship now is being, or that care and that respect is being evoked toward my own body and toward my mind and toward the parts in my unconscious and toward my hurts as though they're a child, you know, that I'm caring for. So that's what we are working on now. But now, once that all these parts are settled and cared for, and they don't feel isolated or pushed away, you know, or unloved or uncared, or they don't feel like they're worthless and no good and all of these things that can be taking place in the unconscious. So there's somebody caring for them. Then the buddhi itself now has taken care of all of these parts. Now the buddhi can meditate and go toward itself being held by Ishvara. It comes then, it's free now, having taken care of all the children, so to speak, you know, and getting everybody settled. Now it's free, you know, to relate itself, because of your knowledge, to relate itself to Ishvara, you know. And it can hold all of the parts and relate all of the parts, unconscious parts, to Ishvara also, you know. And it can also resolve into its own self, into the Atma, which is the truth of the whole thing, really. The truth, the self of the inner friend, you know, the very swabhava, the very nature of the buddhi, of the world, in fact, is the Atma. The Atma is ananda, it's wholeness, it's fullness. And so when the buddhi initially separates itself from the problems, from the body that needs to relax, from the mind that has some worries and hurts, there's a viveka there. It's coming into relationship with it. It's coming into relationship with the unconscious children parts and emotional parts. When it comes into relationship with these things, it has, just by the mere fact of doing it, the buddhi has differentiated itself from those things that it's come into relationship with. And in that process of differentiation, then it's holding those things with love that allows those parts themselves to relax. But because the buddhi has differentiated itself from these parts, it enjoys a shanti that then it gives to the parts. Might have to listen to this more. Now that buddhi doesn't have agitation because it's differentiated itself from agitation and hurt, and it's helping the parts that have agitation and hurt. Itself is free of it. And now it can recognize its own swarupa, its own nature, easily, which is the Atma, right? Because the buddhi already has shanti. And the activity of the buddhi is not something that covers or competes with the fullness of your own nature. Now, in the end, the buddhi is also differentiated from the fullness of your own nature. The buddhi, the self of the buddhi, is the Atma, right? And that is where the true shanti is, the shanti that never comes and goes, that can never come and go, that can never change in any way. The buddhi has the capacity to, you know, get annoyed or get involved in this or involved in that, you know, get distracted. It can do all kinds of things. The Atma can't. The self is always the same. It is always abiding. It never changes in any way. It's never distant from you. It is you. And so, in fact, the real inner friend is the Atma, is the self. You know, it's not talking, it's not speaking, you know. It just is being, but the nature of you really is the beloved. The nature of your being really is the beloved. Now, we need the buddhi, which has for itself the self, the beloved, as its very being. We need it because it can help these different parts by talking to them. What's wrong with you? Why are you feeling this way? Tell me about it. Because these parts in the mind and the unconscious need that level of attention. They need to talk, and they need somebody to love it in order to release affect, the affect that they're holding. So they need this type of love and care. They need words. They need a person, right? But the self is the one that is really, yourself is really the wholeness that's healing everything. And then what you realize is as you start contemplating in the light of your knowledge that the inner friend is the Atma. And you're never not there. You're there as the self of the buddhi. You hold the buddhi. Yeah, the buddhi holds the manas, right? The buddhi holds the manas and the physical body and all of these things. But the self of the buddhi, the truth of the buddhi is the self, and the self isn't away from the buddhi or the manas or the body or the world, right? And nothing hurts it, nothing changes it, nothing can touch it in any way. And so what happens with this viveka is you kind of get used to this. The one who is in the forefront of your experience, if I talk about experience here, like we're experiencing through our sense organs, we're experiencing this room through all five sense organs, and you're, through the sense of touch, you're experiencing your body, and then you have your mind with its moods and emotions and all of this activity that's taking place. All activity, all perception, all cognition, everything that you're experiencing has for its being yourself, which is wholeness and fullness and never changing in any way. So that's just what you need to recognize. And we're doing all of this so that you can recognize that fact, because the mind is so used to being so engaged with itself and with its problems and with it this and that. First we have to settle everybody down. Yeah. So everybody has to settle down. And the only way anybody settles down is through love, really, you know. And the love that involves liking and respect, giving benefit of the doubt, knowing that you are a good person. You know, one Lauren Peterson, as I've told you, I don't know who's heard this, but anyway, Lauren Peterson's a Jungian analyst in Walnut Creek, and I did one of my... He was my supervisor when I was becoming a therapist. He was one of my supervisors. And he was very profound in many ways. And one thing he told me was that, you know, love really... how does a person know that or feel that they're loved? Is really when they feel understood. You know, and they feel understood. And I really spent some time reflecting on that, and I think it's so true. You know, when a person feels seen, they feel understood, you know. And if you look inside your own psyche, even, like, you can feel sometimes that even though you may not be living up to some of your expectations, or things aren't, your behavior or whatever isn't going quite the way that you would like it to be, but you know that you're a good person. Everybody does. You know you're a good person, and that you're trying, you know. But then do other people know that? You know it, but you need other people to know it. And so if another person really knows that, you know, they see through all of our foibles and everything, and they know that you, they see you, the person, that's such a relief, you know? And we have to consciously be able to see that in others, but see it in ourself. If it becomes natural to seeing it in yourself, to seeing all of these kind of things in yourself, then you do see it in others. It's an odd situation when you have kindness and love and giving benefit of the doubt to others, but you're not, you don't do it, you don't turn it this way. There's some funny disconnect there, even though we all do that. But there's a funny disconnect. It doesn't really work. There's not a real integrity going on there, even though there's a kind of, it's not that you do that on purpose. It has to be brought to consciousness. Yeah, but it's really only when you treat yourself in the same way that you treat others that there's not a disconnect. Makes it really a big difference. So. There, that's my meditation talk for today.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, it's good. You have to try it. Try yeah. these things. We'll work. I'll start doing more meditation.
You'll help us with it too.
Yes, I will.
Promise.
I promise. You have to remind me. But it does. It makes such a huge difference. It's not. It's a huge thing, really. You know, because the parts inside that keep us hurting are being taken care of, and. The funny thing is, if we don't do it, take care of those parts, they don't really get taken care of, because a lot of those parts are child parts in the unconscious. And we can have adult relationships, but those children parts aren't being heard. You know, you have to go and be with all of those parts on their own level. And it's even true when you're asking your own mind, the conscious mind, you know, what do you have on your mind? Even the conscious mind appreciates being asked. I don't know if you notice that. I notice it in my mind. If I say, okay, what is it that you're concerned about, that you want to get done today, or something bothering you? And I'll always be kind of surprised, and I'll say, oh, that's right. You know, but what that means is that the mind is carrying things that have not, is not integrated. Like if you give the mind the chance to just say, you know, then the buddhi knows, everybody knows. It's not one side has to, one compartment is not having to carry it by itself, that type of thing. But there's ego states, there's compartments. And you can realize that as you start doing a lot of this type of dialogue. You know, and you can feel the relaxation that it brings about.
Like when you were finished with the meditation tonight, I was so peaceful I didn't want to move. I couldn't move. It was almost visceral.
It is, yeah. That's nice.
Yeah. And happy to be that way. It was very pleasing.
And that's another thing, is that the source of the ananda is Atma. That's why when we do all of these things, you know, you quieten everything, you relax all the parts, then you've kind of removed the pain, really. You're removing the pain and then you're fine. You see what I mean? You kind of remove these the painful situations, and then why aren't you just a big zero then? You know, you remove everything. But it's not true. You remove these conflicts and pains and whatnot, and then what you're left with is your own shining. And then now that person can meditate or not.
But when you speak about the child interjects
Interjects.
Interjects. Does that actually look to the mind as an adult, critical adult?
It can.
That's the interject.
Yeah. But, you know, it depends on your mind, like the way that the mind can, it can have it by feeling. It can be audio, you know, hearing, just hearing it. It can, your mind and psyche can be more visually oriented.
Yeah.
You know, so it just depends upon the individual's type of mind.
Yeah. But it looks like an authority, mean authority figure is running the show here.
Often, yes.
But it's actually the child's interjection of how it should behave.
That's right. And the, well, just think about, it's the three-year-old, I'm using three or four, could be four-year-old or whatever. The three-year-old is interjecting the parent. A three-year-old mind is swallowing the hostile or the mean parent, right?
As in growing up.
Yeah, you're 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You're the parent is...
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So the child, this three-year-old, buddhi, you know, is interjecting their image of that parent. See what I mean? And so that's why I'm saying that you can actually, it's very effective sometimes to realize that that's really a little child dressed in daddy's shoes.
That's what I want to hear.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's the point right there.
And when you understand that, then you can be much more loving and kind to that.
Yeah, because the child is easy to be loving to.
Yeah.
But the adult isn't, but if you realize it, it's a child wearing the daddy's shoes.
Exactly. And then it really feels such a relief if you can come and soothe it, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's got a big job to do.
Yeah.
You know, to try to keep you in line. And also, they say, and I think the psychological, I think this resonates as being true, I mean, for me. It's called anticipatory anxiety. It's like with a little child. This is also, well, it's also true for adults, but for a child. If you have a mean parent, violent parent, you know that parent's coming home.
Yeah.
And as you know it's going to be coming home, you start getting more and more tense, more and more anxious. And so what a child will do is that anticipatory anxiety is so much, you know, that they would rather imagine, you know, like create inside and then just deal with it so that they don't have to live in the fear and horror of this thing approaching. Mm-hmm. And so they create that internal situation. You know, they interject the parent. And then that's better than and just dealing with it now. You see what I mean?
What would that look like in that moment for the child to sit there and kind of turn it inward?
It would be like this. Say, you have a violent parent. The violent parent is coming home. There's more and more stress and fear that's building up. And so then what happens is that the child imagines inside, in an imaginal space, the violent parent yelling, you know? And now there's no more anticipatory anxiety because now they're actually facing it. And so it's been internalized. Another thing that sometimes you'll see with little children, this is a little tangential, but you know, if they're playing in sand play or anything like that, or with sometimes we'll have them play in a dollhouse, they'll have the father beating the baby. Like they'll have the little father doll, the little baby doll, and the father go, like that, you know. Just acting out all of this kind of violent, very violent play over and over and over and over again to kind of work it out of their system somehow. You know? Because they internalize it.
But, you know, it's not always just violence. It's a whole range of emotions.
It is, yeah. I'm talking about the positive emotions aren't really a problem. Because when we're with the positive emotions, they don't They aren't things that we want to push away. They are kind of resonate with the nature of your own being. But the negative emotions don't resonate with your being. You know, so they are like intruders. They're people, things we want to get rid of and want to escape.
So that could be like insecurity or worry or anything, fear.
That's right. All of those things. But sometimes it helps, like, say you're overwhelmed with insecurity. Then you can visualize like this. There's a little child inside who's feeling very worried and insecure. You know? But what an adult will do is say, I'm so worried and insecure. But what they could do is say, realize there's a little child inside who's feeling worried and insecure, and then go in and help it. That's the buddhi coming into the manas, and say, you're feeling so worried and insecure, tell me about it. Tell me what it is, what's really scaring you. And then you let that part explain it and talk. Because otherwise, if you don't do that, you don't do it because you don't know about it. But say you understand that, and you do come in and talk to that part, then that part becomes secure because it's no longer just the feelings of a three-year-old, you know? Now, it's the feelings of a three-year-old who's being held by a loving parent or loving, you know, whatever.
Somebody cares?
Yeah, yeah. And so then that's a huge, huge relief for that part. But if you don't know about that, then when that insecure feeling comes into the mind, because it's been triggered by something, you don't know what, mm-hmm. but comes into the mind, then you just feel, I'm just a really fearful, insecure person. Right? Because there's no knowledge of how to kind of separate and go and be with that part.
So there's really that distance then?
Yes. It's not a physical distance, but it's the distance of, you know, coming into relationship with. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You get me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We can carry on.
We can carry on. We'll carry on.
It's very soothing.
It is soothing. Swamiji does beautiful meditations on this now. Because he sees, he gets it completely. As you start working with it, you'll find your way. Because it is something that really happens inside, you know. Just as you find your way with your own child, you find your way with your own pet. I find my way with Tibby. You know, we find our way, you know. So internally also you find your way. You also know what happened to you when you were growing up and what your fears and what were the things that you faced when you were growing up? You know, what did your parents face? Also through osmosis, you take on the worries and concerns of your parents, too. Not just in their relationship to you, mm-hmm. but in what they themselves were carrying. Mm-hmm. Then you as a child are carrying those things too. Mm-hmm. You know, and the things are, I mean, here we are kind of in Kali Yuga, you know. I mean, the things that we are having to carry in this era are a lot. And so sometimes it's not enough just to sit in meditation and let all the kashayas, we call them, all the impurities just rise up and go away. We need to, you know, we need to expedite, facilitate that process a little bit, you know.
Mm.
And it's really helpful.
Well, what's interesting is, I think what you're saying is, I notice that with Mira, you know, a lot. When she has a problem, and it takes the time, I slow down my own process to where I can actually really pay attention to where she's at, then there's nothing that needs to be fixed. You know, it's kind of resolving into itself, just like you were saying so beautifully, when you can really connect with that part that hurts. You know, there's a certain kind of validation that takes place that just resolves the whole thing. And so I see that. So she's such a great mirror for me in that way, because she shows me like exactly what you were saying, where I need to do my own healing with my own pain body, so to speak. She demonstrates to me that this is possible immediately. You know, there's an immediate resolution.
Yeah.
And so she demonstrates this over and over. There's just total forgiveness that is playing itself out nonstop when I can drop in with her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's amazing.
That's,
I mean,
right.
That's what
yeah.
a teaching.
Yeah.
I think about that a lot.
Yeah. The immediacy of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's beautiful. It's such a beautiful thing.
Yeah, yeah.
The mind, the psyche is not a physical, you know, like if I rip this, if I were to rip my chair, I have to actually do something, you know, to mend it.
Yeah.
Right? But the psyche is much more fluid than that.
Mm.
You can change on a dime, in a sense. The trauma's a lot, though. You have to change on a dime over and over again. Like Swamiji uses the example of, you know, somebody, the tenth, you know, the tenth man story?
Mm-hmm.
And the tenth man realizes, you know, I'm the tenth man, but before he realizes, he was so freaked out, you know, he was so terribly freaked out that he beat his head against a tree and got cut and all kinds of stuff, and then he realized, finally, I'm the tenth man, but then he'd keep forgetting, am I really the tenth man, you know, because it was so traumatic, thinking that all those people could have, somebody has died and all of that.
It's almost a brain, it's almost a brain pattern that's set there.
Yeah.
Even though he knows he's a tenth.
Yeah, because he's so...
The neurons, I mean, the whole pattern, the whole system is set up for the, he's not the tenth.
Yeah.
But it's hard, because of my practice, I work with people on this, you know, the inner critic or the inner child. But when the person doesn't know that they're whole and complete, ultimately, then it's much harder to work with.
Much harder.
Much harder, because then there's not the context where you can say, okay, I've done my work, I give it up to Bhagavan, now you do your part.
Yeah. And there's not that constant presence of wholeness.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
It's always like, there is underneath is still the idea, I'm not whole and complete.
Absolutely.
Something is completely wrong. And it's so much harder to... I mean, it gets through. I can see it. You know,
it's still helpful. Okay. It's still helpful, but it doesn't. It doesn't resolve into an absolute completion. Yeah.
So you've noticed that too.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I think people get kinder and more compassionate.
They do,
and
they get a relative peace, but it's only relative. It's not. It doesn't. The solution. It's not. The problem's not completely solved.
Mm-hmm. Where does the ego come in? Is that part of the manas?
The ego is part of the buddhi, really. The ego is really just the I thought that identifies, I mean the ahankara. It's the I thought that identifies with different parts of the body, like identifies with the body, identifies with an emotion, identifies with the mind. You know. If I could say, you know, I'm a woman, I'm tall, you know, I have brown eyes or whatever. The ahankara is that which is identifying the self with the upadhi. I'm happy, I'm sad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is that what you meant, Evie?
Yes. Well, I read one of Swamiji's articles that was making the differentiation between the ahankara and myself, and that seemed to be, I don't know, it just kind of cleared something up for me.
Well, the ahankara is an I thought, right? And the atma, the self, illumines that thought along with all other thoughts. Right? Like say if I say, you know, what if I say the thought, the words, I am Brahman? That's true, but the words are I am Brahman. That's a vritti that I'm illumining, right? Or, you know, I could say, what a beautiful painting. You know, I could see the beautiful painting, that's a vritti, then I can label the beautiful painting what a beautiful painting. That's a vritti. The Atma is illumines as the very self of all of the vrittis, including the Ahankara. But the Ahankara also is just a vritti. I can say I'm my body. No, that's a vritti. I am Brahman. That's a vritti. Right? But the truth, but the thing is with this knowledge, I mean, a teacher can't just walk in and say, okay, I am Brahman, say it. And then you say, I am Brahman. Okay, good, now go home. It's not like that. You know, the words have to resolve into the reality of it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you still, if you make the statement, I am Brahman, those are three words which you're aware of, and you know that those three words are labeling your being, which you know. Indirect understanding would be like, if I say, the Upanishads tell me, say, the Upanishads say, I am Brahman. Right? That's indirect knowledge, because I don't know what they mean. It's true what I say, the Upanishads say, the Upanishads teach that I am Brahman. That's a vritti. There's no knowledge in the vritti except the truth that the Upanishads say, I am Brahman. But there's no one, there's no knowledge of what I am Brahman means. Right.
Well, there's no recognition.
Yeah, there's no recognition. All you know is that the Upanishads reveal that I am Brahman. And then you say, and I would like to know that. Right? But the jnani is the one who has self-knowledge, is the one who has been taught. And then when they say, if you say, I am Brahman, there's that vritti there, but that vritti is properly labeling your self-evident me.
Mm.
You know? Mm. Just like if I say, you know, lamp. L-A-M-P, lamp. That's properly labeling this lamp. I don't need the lamp. I don't need the label, but the label is true to the lamp. Right? So if I say I am Brahman, and I know myself, then that label is true to me. But for an Ajnani, somebody that doesn't have knowledge, they say, I am Brahman, then you have to say, I don't know what that means, but that's what the Upanishads teach.
It seems to me for this really to work, you need to do both.
What do you mean?
Both you need what? To do the inner work with the unconscious to make it very, very peaceful, and then you need to have the knowledge that you are peace.
Yeah, that's right. You need to do this type of work just to settle down the antakarna, the upadis, so that they're available for knowledge.
Mm.
And also so that you don't have to walk around with a broken leg. It's like, you can know I'm Brahman, but your leg's broken. And that really hurts. And so you want to, you know, put it in a cast and take care of it so it'll heal. So you say you've been able to, you have some clarity of mind to the degree that at the time of teaching you're able to see, but then those parts are hurting. So now we have to go in and take care of them so that they're not hurting. Why should they be hurting? We don't let people in the world hurt. You know, if there's something that's in pain, then you want to help and relieve the pain.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to say to your leg, like, you're Brahman.
Stop
you know,
hurting.
To your broken leg, you're Brahman. You know, why are you hurting? You're Brahman. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's hurting because the leg's broken. You know, and now say, your mind has, you know, because of childhood experiences and whatnot, it has a lot of complexes and a lot of hurts, and those things are triggered all the time. And then you say, you're Brahman. Why are you still acting like this? It's apples and oranges.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these things are causing pain because they haven't been dealt with in a way to release the dealt with in a way to release that pain. We have to know these things to take care of them, you know, or just say, well, I'm suffering, but, you know, so what? But then the mind will say, but I don't want to suffer, you know?
I don't want to suffer.
You know, and then you should be saying, as a compassionate person, you'd say, I'll do everything I can to help you. Just like you would say to a person in the world, let me do what I can, I'll try to help you. That should be the attitude. because you would have that attitude to somebody in the world or even to an animal or to a plant. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We done?
Yeah. Thank you. This is very wonderful. Extraordinary.
Thank you.
And that's all because of you.